This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Are you ready, Hannah Dunleavy?
I am.
Okay.
Standard Issue for all women.
Hello, and welcome to episode 295 of the Standard Issue podzine. I'm Nikki Noonan, and I am really close to falling out with the murder fish.
Is that a euphemism?
No, it's the tank of murder fish that lives in my house. And they have killed my favourite. Not just killed and eaten my favourite fish. The only gentle fish left in the tank is no longer. Poor Barbara.
What type of fishes are they, Mick? Because we used to have
fucking
this.
Fucking Aggie fish. The barbs, which are Aggie, but we've ended up with an Aggie tank because they were like, well, you've got some Aggie ones now, so you either just wait for them to eat all the others and die and then start again, or you make it an Aggie tank. And Gary was like, let's have an Aggie tank then. So they're very beautiful, but they are bastards.
My brother used to keep tropical fish, and I'm not even going to tell you what they used to do because it was fucking gross and Hannah will be sick, but
thank you.
It's unpleasant, and I'll let your imagination do the rest.
I am grateful for your consideration there, Jen. If you could teach my fish some consideration, that would be much appreciated.
If there were anything like our fish. We had catfish and something else. Can't remember what they were. And I can't remember who the killers were, to be honest.
Thanks for taking part there, Jen.
Sorry.
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and I think I've found the friendliest city on earth.
Is it an in-real-life city, or have you been online?
Yeah, I made it.
It's The Sims.
Baltimore, Maryland. What an incredibly friendly place.
Come on now. We've seen The Wire.
Honestly, three separate people, for no reason other than I just passed them in the street, said, hey, ma'am. How are you going?
Have you forgotten your belt again, Hannah?
No, not even that. I didn't have any, what the Americans call, cell service, so I had to ask for directions sometimes, and everyone was crazy friendly, honestly. However, the very first thing I heard anyone utter as I stepped off the train to Baltimore was a kid on a phone who went, that shit ain't right. I was delighted by it.
Oh, it's so lovely when you hear a catchphrase. It's like when Nick Miller and I were in New York and the restaurant owner called one of his waitstaff a jerk off. We were like, yeah. Yes, please.
Did you meet any corrupt politicians who said, shit?
I did not, Jen, unfortunately. Big recommend for Baltimore if anyone's looking at it.
I'm Jen Offord, and sometimes when I'm driving, I imagine the person in the car behind me is thinking, they are really good for a learner driver. But I've been learning for 14 months now. That should sort of be a given. But yeah.
I like that. I'm all for bigging yourself up because I do feel it makes us better at stuff. You know, if I'm trying to lift a certain weight and I go, I can't do this, I won't be able to do it. But if I'm like, come on, Mickey, get this motherfucker up, you can. It goes up. So I love that you're just like, I am such a good driver. Well done, me.
I am such a good learner driver who hasn't passed their test yet after 14 months of learning. I mean, I suppose if you want to call that bigging myself up, who knows?
Coming up, journalist Annabel Hirsch chats with me about what a mad mix of objects can tell us about women's lives throughout history and how it feels to have Helena Bonham Carter, Leila Slimani, Olivia Colman, Margaret Atwood and Mira Sayal be just a few of the women on board with your project.
Wowzers. In Jenny Off the Blocks, I talk to Rachel Ramsey and Victoria Gregory, director and producer of the new feature documentary Copper 71 about Mexico's 1971 unofficial World Cup.
And strap in, Mickey's French accent is back as we watch 1989's Dangerous Liaisons, waves fan furiously.
Sacre bleu! But first, drop shots, cheap shots, and S-O goddamn S, it's time for the Bush Telegraph. Cue Sting.
Bush Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph, where there is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. You have read about Willy's chocolate experience in Glasgow, Jen. Tell me you have.
I know a bit about it. I've seen that funny silver face terror beast appearing out of a wall, and I think maybe an Oompa Loompa. I'm not sure. Talk to me about it, Mickey. Tell me.
It's basically the fire festival for kids, Jen. They built this experience taking place in Glasgow. They did all the advertising with AI, and it looks incredible, like just like the room in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. I'm obviously talking about the Gene Wilder version because he's a legend. But yeah, it was going to be this incredible thing. You could actually experience Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. They promised surprises around every corner. And I've got to tell you, they kind of didn't disappoint on that. Although it does depend on your definition of the word surprise. So if you turned up into what was basically just a warehouse with a couple of banners and the saddest Oompa Loompa you've ever seen, people were not happy, Jen. They wanted their £44 a ticket back.
£44!
And rightly wow. So.
Yeah.
The photos are the funniest, saddest things I have ever seen. And I want more of this, to be honest with you. It was the only bright spot in the news this week.
While we're on the subject.
Absolutely less lols from now on as we have a look at Lil Rishi Sunak's Downing Street speech on Friday. The tag comes courtesy of recently elected MP for Rochdale, George Galloway. And I do think it is best said as Little Rishi Sunak. Now, I've long thought Galloway to be an insufferable, arrogant, misogynist twat. And yep. It'll take more than the people of Rochdale to change my mind on that one. But he's right. Sunak is small. He is a small man. And I'm not having a pop at his stature. Wheeling the Lexan outside number 10 and doing some talking is, of course, a privilege of the serving Prime Minister. But it usually happens when there's something important to say or an emergency. We saw a lot of that lectern during the COVID pandemic, for example. So maybe on Friday, Sunak was using this privilege to condemn the IDF opening fire on starving people trying to reach aid trucks in Gaza. No, of course he wasn't. His target was closer to home. And that target was, extremist groups are a growing threat to British democracy. Sunak's hop-off point was the populist Galloway's, quote, beyond alarming by-election win in Rochdale, hence the man previously and bafflingly known as Gorgeous George, literally belittling the Prime Minister. Like I said, I wasn't voting for Galloway when he was on Big Brother, and I wouldn't be voting for him now. But what's properly beyond alarming, Little Rishi Sunak, is the egregious hypocrisy of the leader of a party that has made it harder to vote, criminalised the right to protest, attacked the Electoral Commission and is currently plotting to curb the power of the courts to scrutinise government policy, claimed to be some sort of champion of democracy. And yeah, Islamophobia is rife, anti-Semitism is rife, racism is rife, division is rife in the UK. But I don't know, Little Rishi Sunak, could be that has something to do with the fact that very extremism you're criticising is actively driven by your party, even in bits of this fucking speech. Sure, you might have just suspended him, but you also made Lee Anderson your deputy chairman. Swella Braverman, for fuck's sake. Also, the Rwanda bill, anyone?
Yeah.
It is election year, and oh, for the love of fuck, please let that be soon. So this sort of political grandstanding, and let's call it what it is, gaslighting, is to be expected. But I started this by saying Sunak is small, so I'll explain. This 10-minute speech was all talk and no trousers, with barely a whiff of policy. Because if he wasn't shitting himself about the result, Sunak would have used that time to call a general election.
I ranted at my mother for about 20 minutes solidly this morning about how heinous this government is and how they are just, and I wrote about it in the Mail out last week and I talk about it all the time at the moment, and it makes me so full of rage. I do sometimes wonder, like, what it is doing to our national kind of psyche that we have to live with this sort of level of rage at all times. They are going to cling on for as long as they fucking can because they know they're out of power for a decade or longer, and they are scraping every tiny last bit of meat off the bones before they go. And that's it. This party has got no policies, no clue, no nothing. It is just deflection, and it is dangerous. It's really, really fucking dangerous because they are, as you say, whipping up hate on purpose to distract from the fact that they've got nothing else going on.
Which is why it's so important, and I know Jen has stressed this in the Bush Telegraph before, and I know you stress it in the mail out, make sure you have voter ID so that you can use your vote, use your democracy that they're trying to destroy to get these fuckers out.
While we're busy looking at little Rishi Sunak
over
there.
Do the voice, Jen.
Little Rishi Sunak over there. Maybe they're hoping we're not looking at the economic turmoil over here. I feel like I'm talking about economic turmoil quite a bit at the moment, but it is with good reason as we approach another budget. And Jeremy Hunt, I said Hunt.
Well done. I've never been more proud of you, Jen.
Thanks. Finds himself scrabbling around for some tax cuts. Tax cuts, eh? We like those, don't we? Until, you know, the interest on our mortgages skyrocket, or we can't get a doctor's appointment without first selling a kidney. In fact, for those of us most dependent on functional public services, tax cuts aren't great. Taxes have funded for the last 2.5 years the Household Support Fund, aimed at bolstering those most in need, while the, in inverted commas, because you know how I feel about this and I still feel the same way, cost of living crisis bites.
How did that happen, Jen? That sounds very passive. How did a cost of living crisis occur?
I don't know. I think it's a natural disaster, yeah, don't you, Mickey?
Yeah,
it's,
I think so, yeah.
In no way. This is what I hate about cost of living crisis. It sort of like pitches it as this unavoidable thing that wasn't caused by like gross fucking mismanagement of an economy over a long period of time. I don't know if I can say that. Can I say mismanagement? Is that technically libelous? I'm not sure.
Who's going to see you? Little Rishi Sunak.
Rishi fucking Sunak. Who knows? Anyway, household costs haven't actually come down in any kind of meaningful way yet. And indeed, research by the Resolution Foundation think tank in January this year, so like 2 months ago, suggested that the worst was yet to come. But let's close that fund anyway, says the government, because benefits are rising, so why not? But, you know, I suppose if benefits were insufficient in the first place, that might be your first reason.
Oh, Jen, I feel like you're trying to use logic here, but please carry on.
I'm going to. I guess if charities such as Bernardo's, who provide support to vulnerable families on the ground, are warning you that closing the fund would have, and I quote, catastrophic consequences, maybe that's your second. Attempts to limit access to benefits, well, maybe that's third.
I feel like you're nitpicking, Jen.
Nitpicking. It's not just Bernardo's either. On Monday, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation warned that further tax cuts risked a lost decade for living standards and a loss of £1,900 per year to working families. And what's worse?
Worse?
I know, fair enough. But according to a YouGov poll of 5,000 people across the UK, no one's even asking for tax cuts. The overwhelming priority, said the charity, was fixing the NHS and other public services. Still, can you see some small boats over there, Mickey?
Stop the boats. Stop the boats. And by that I mean stop the boats by making safe and legal forms of immigration available.
Do you want some good news?
Please, put it in my eyes and my ears and my other orifices. Sorry.
Well, does your blood pressure feel just like a little bit higher after that? Because mine does.
I'm sweating.
Yeah. Let me bring it down. So, good sports news, no less. So, since today's Jenny Off The Blocks is an interview, couldn't resist the opportunity to squeeze into the pod scene somewhere that British tennis player Katie Bolter has won her first WTA 500 title with a victory over Marta Kostyuk at the San Diego Open. Bolter came back from a set down to win 5-7, 6-2, 6-2 and secure her highest ever ranking of 27th in the world, putting her inside the top 50 for the first time ever. I don't know what just happened, she said after the match. Oh, congratulations to you, Katie.
Yeah, congratulations, Katie. More news next week.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week.
It's that time of the year when I am sorely tempted to point out the various levels of tomfuckery that now comprise International Women's Day. It's March the 8th, if you still give a shit. The theme suggested by internationalwomensday.com for the year 2024 is hashtag inspire inclusion. Which means, the tagline suggests, that, quote, International Women's Day belongs to everyone, everywhere.
Does it?
Sorry. I just face-palmed so hard that I've given myself a black eye, and it still feels better than reading that piss-poor excuse for feminism. The brilliant Sophie Walker has an excellent piece on her Substack about this, and I'm on board with her idea of ditching International Women's Day and the corporate sewerage it's become, and embracing Women's Independence Day. Because, as Sophie quite rightly says, and this is a quote, why, this year of all years, are we not focusing on the appalling misery, brutality, starvation and violation of women's rights in Gaza, Afghanistan, Yemen, the DRC? How can we possibly mark an international day about the female experience without feeling ashamed at the extent to which these women and so many, many more have been utterly let down?
Yep.
If we want to look at women a little closer to home who have also been utterly let down, I do realise that won't someone think of the bankers isn't a popular cry, but sexism in the city is real. I wish I could take credit for that moniker, but it's genuinely the official title of a parliamentary inquiry into sexism and misogyny in the city, i.e. London's financial district. Jen, do you want to guess if it's improved since 2018?
From your tone, I could hazard a guess, but you continue, mate. Go on.
Well, you can take what you want from my tone, because we won't actually find out for sure until the report is released next week. But you could see that one coming, couldn't you? But stories shared by more than 40 women from the financial services industry during a closed-door session of the inquiry suggest the dial has moved, in that it's taken itself into the shadows where bad behaviour has become, in the committee's words, law underhand and pernicious, and persistent misogyny remains the norm. It's good, isn't it? Great stuff. 2024. Anyway, I'm sure the self-styled alpha males in the city are proper excited about International Women's Day, what with it being for everyone and everything.
Fucking hell.
Hello, I'm joined on the Zoom by journalist, writer and translator Annabel Hirsch, whose book, A History of Women in 101 Objects, is a properly fascinating walk through female history via, I mean, well, the title does say it, 101 objects, some remarkable, some everyday, and all with a different story to tell. Annabel, hello.
Hello.
So, first things first, where did the idea for A History of Women and 101 Objects come from?
Well, the idea was born in, I would say, probably many or on different levels or in different moments of my life as a journalist, but maybe also as a woman. For the German newspaper I write for, I kind of mainly write about women. When I moved to Paris, I suddenly became like this expert on women writers, female topics and all that stuff. And I have always been also very interested in women and women's literature. And so I thought it would be nice to write a history of women, because I realized that I know a lot about the 19th century, basically through literature, but that I don't know so much about the real life that women had. And I had the feeling that, you know, in the last years, we have so many rediscoveries. You know, we try to rewrite history in a female way, and that is amazing. And I think there are so many amazing things that have been done in this sense. But then also I had the feeling that often we try to rewrite it in the sense that we would say women did the same stuff as men. They were also powerful. They were also very important. They also invented stuff, which is totally true. And it's super important to say that.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't tell us so much about the daily life, right? Or it doesn't tell us so much about how was it beside this exceptional women or beside this exceptional moments to be a woman? What were the ideas society had about women? How did they themselves feel about their lives, their body, their relationship to love and stuff? And I had the feeling that through objects, to me, it felt like it's the easiest way, in the sense that an object is like a central bridge to the past. It's something that is mainly, not always, also in the book, not always, but mainly part of the intimate space. So it's something that hadn't been there in daily life. It's something that had witnessed, you know, the also boring moments.
It's quite a direct connection, yeah?
It is. To me, it is. To me, it's really like a silent witness that nobody asked, you know? They saw everything. They heard everything. They saw when people were crying, laughing, or getting angry. They saw the big moments of history. Also because women have always been perceived as objects, so it kind of sidekicks of history. And to me, objects are also perceived in a way as sidekicks to history. We tend to feel history is made of big wars, big treaties, important people that were loud and powerful and strong, which is true. But then it's also true that if history was only this, we wouldn't live. History is a lot of, of the small and repetitive and, I mean, too many people boring moments. I find them the most interesting.
I've got to say, your book is the furthest away from boring that you could get, and also made me angry in the introduction when you were explaining your idea and where it came from. And a man said, but women are objects. And is that man still breathing?
I suppose he is. No, this was, when I was at this dinner, it was in Paris, and it was dinner with people from the publishing world. And I mean, so people that thought of themselves as very important. And they were in their little circle, but then what does it mean for the big world, right? And so when I told about this this idea, and I was just at the beginning, so I didn't know exactly what I would do. But I said, yeah, I think it should talk about the relationship people had, women had to their body, to motherhood, to sex, to love, to writing, thinking, art, power, all this stuff. And so I was talking to a woman, actually, because she asked me what objects could there be. And then he interrupted me and he said, like laughing, he said, women are objects. And then, and she was very happy about this
pleased
extremely
with himself.
Stupid comment. But then I thought, in this moment, I was sure that I'm going to put this in the book, because I thought then, I mean, it's extremely stupid, but then it is true in the sense that we have told history as if it was true.
Yes.
As if women has been objects that were sitting passively, silently in a corner, which is totally untrue.
Let's get back to the actual objects. Why 101?
So the German edition, actually, which I wrote first, I wrote it in German, is 100. So this is a bit of a debate, I have to admit, because, well, when I started the idea, I talked to my editor and we thought we're not going to do the history of women in 50 objects. That would sound ugly, right? So, and so we said, okay, let's say 100. And at the beginning, I thought, this is a lot. I'm going to be like struggling to find 100 objects. And then while I was researching very, very quickly, actually, I realized that 100 is nothing. And so I tried to convince her. I was like, you know, maybe we should do 120 or 150. That would be very like original. She was not convinced about this amazing idea, unfortunately. And so we said 100 because it's easy. And for the English edition, actually, we made it 101 because when Canongate bought the book, it was just a moment when the, let's say, revolution in Iran or the demonstrations in the street in Iran started. I closed the German edition in 2017 on the pussy head because to me it felt like Me Too, the March on Washington, you know, this one's something that was really a breaking point in history, like a really like a new wave, but also a moment where we couldn't say this is a closed moment. We don't know what Me Too will really change in our society, right?
Yeah.
So I really like that it's the end, but actually it's at a very open end. So this was the idea. And so when this in Iran happened, I felt like it would be absurd to not put that in there, because to me it felt like this is after Me Too probably the next big thing. Yes. In female history, because it also, it doesn't concern only women in Iran, right? I mean, it's about female rights, it's about basic human rights, and I was very impressed that the way also men participated on this, that it showed that they don't think that female rights are particular right, and that female rights are human rights. And I felt like this is extremely important. And also what I felt is good about it is that this also is an open end, because we don't know. I mean, it's still going on. We don't talk about it so much, but we don't know what this will really change. for women of this cultural area. Also, I like that it opens to another cultural area, because my book is, I have treated it very Western, because I, at the beginning, I also thought I'm going to do a history of the world and I'm going to talk about women in Africa and in Asia and it's going to be amazing. And then while I was researching, I realized that this is totally undoable for me, because it's very subjective, it's very personal. There are many things in there that I really like that probably, it's not like they're so important for female history, but I feel like they're important. So I did something that is very, very close to me and that I can really relate to. And I felt if I would talk about women from a cultural space that I know from afar, but that actually I cannot really relate to, this would be a cliche, and I didn't want to do that. But with Iran, I was happy that in a way, yeah, it opens to a new cultural space. I'm not going to write about this more than one object, but maybe someone else should. I mean, it's more like a, yeah, like a way to say, okay, now there's an open history, right, that can be written also.
It's an invitation. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, a bit, yeah.
The objects themselves, from a healed femur to a nun's crown to a Singer sewing machine to a hunger strike medal to the bikini to Aretha Franklin's respect to that bunch of hair, which is the chapter about Iran. This is a really, really wide-ranging collection of objects.
Yeah.
How did you choose them?
I wanted it to be wide. This was very important to me, you know, that it's not only talking about female relationship to power, for example, or not only about great inventors or not only about great artists. I wanted to have all of this in there, but then also to talk, to talk about life, to talk about, I have Aretha Franklin in there because I wanted to have music in there. I have a lot of objects are about sexuality, I would say. So the choice was made on probably two levels. One was that I wanted it to be chronological, because what I found very interesting while I did my research and very important to translate in a way is that I think we have this idea that female history is kind of linear and that it goes from submission to emancipation. I thought that too, kind of. And when I did the research, I realized that this is completely untrue, and that it always went in waves, right? That we always had made two steps forward and three steps back.
Yep.
And so we always had the backlashes. And so this was important for me to have this chronological side. So I really tried to find a balance so that I wouldn't have like 40 in the, 18th century and two in the 20th. But what was more important was also to have subjects like what I said, a relationship to the body, to sexuality, to writing, to motherhood, to the public space, which I found super important. And so I kind of found the objects in this mix of those two levels. I mean, mainly it was actually a topic that I wanted to talk about. And then I found the object.
Yeah, fair enough.
But then at one point, actually, the contrary happened. So I wasn't looking anymore in a way, because the objects came to me. I don't really know how, but suddenly there were objects that kind of appeared. You know, if you read so much, if you research so much, suddenly you find stuff that you weren't looking for. And this is when it gets very interesting, actually. Yeah, so I had many objects that then just arrived and that also were fitting to the topics I wanted to talk about. For example, the hat pin. I wasn't searching for that. I had no idea about this story that women around 1900 were using the hat pins kind of as a weapon, which is super fun, I think, and super smart also. And so it was super interesting because the hat pin is really, it's also a very good example of how something that seems so banal, we would never think about this, right? Tells this story about women that start to enter the public space, that start to enter it alone, which was super weird for men. So they felt like, why are there those girls in our sphere? If they are, then we can touch them, right? Because this is our space. So why shouldn't we? And so that women found this way to defend themselves, which is amazing. That also this then became a public discussion. So that around 1900, which to me was totally new, they had big discussions in the US, but also in Europe, about how can we make our streets safer for women. I mean, we're still talking about this, yep. Right? So it's a bit shocking, actually, sometimes to realize that so long ago, we had exactly the same discussions, and so we didn't move very fast. The selection is very very personal, very eclectic. But then obviously I also wanted to talk, you know, about the wars, the revolutions, things like humanism, because I find it interesting. Yeah, and about how women were perceived, but also how women must have felt in different times, in different places.
You mentioned the hat pin. Now, I learned about the hat pin from Helena Bonham Carter. Let's talk about the audiobook released for International Women's Day in collaboration with Refuge, and a really, truly exciting first of its kind. It has collected the voices of 101 remarkable women from all over the world. I mean, I shit you not, listeners. Gillian Anderson is your first reader, and then I picked a few at random and heard former Prime Minister of Australia Julia Gillard telling me about lipstick, Jodie Whittaker talking to me about the bikini, Mira Sayar explaining radium chocolate. I learned about Tupperware via Angelica Houston. What is happening? Kate Winslet, Leila Slimani, Olivia Colman, Margaret Atwood. Annabelle, how did you feel when those names kept coming in?
I was a bit overwhelmed, I have to say. I am still, no, I said, I mean, to me, it's, I find that crazy, I have to admit. No, and I was super happy because they're amazing women, right? And I'm so happy and so honored in a way that they lend me their voice. Also, not me in a way, because to me, when this list started to grow, I really, to me, it was something that I felt like is a super touching, because to me, it's like, you know, like a sorority, and they give their voices to make those women of the past more alive, but that they lend their voices to them more than to me.
I wish the listeners could see your face. It is what I can describe as giddy. It's a giddy face.
No, because I feel also a bit like, you know, like a kid that that was very lucky. It's absurd in a way, yeah.
And it is wonderful that the way they bring these objects and your words to life and give them an extra dimension. It's really very cool. It's such a great listen. I've had a lovely time. Thank you.
Yeah.
A theme that really runs through A History of Women in 101 Objects is the fear of men, of women getting together without men.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I feel like even today, I have the feeling that we kind of realize again that we forgot that probably in the 90s or even early 2000s, how important it is when women come together. Not to exclude men, but, you know, it's different. I think this is something, yeah, that we realize again how important that is, and also how much power that has, obviously.
Yeah.
And yeah, men were very frightened of that.
Yeah.
They hated this. And not all men.
I don't think we need to say not all men. I think it's fine. I think we can exclude men. So, A History of Women in 101 Objects is translated by Eleanor Updegraff, published by Canongate and out now. And that extraordinary audiobook is also available from wherever you get your audiobooks. Annabelle, can people follow you on the socials to find out what 101 Objects you're talking about next?
I'm on Instagram, Annabelle Hirsch.
Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you.
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question, and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time, and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much. That does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny off the blocks. I am joined by one of the directors and producers of the new feature documentary Copper 71, Rachel Ramsey and Victoria Gregory. Thank you very much, guys, for joining me.
Pleasure.
So, can I ask you, first of all, there's a clue in the title there that it's football related, but would you be able to tell me, please, a little bit about the documentary? And also, I'm interested to know, because you've got some pretty big names behind it, how this came about.
It's the story of an unofficial and completely remarkable Women's Football World Cup that happened in 1971 in Mexico. They invited 6 international teams to come and play, and it was a huge commercial and sporting success. They had 110,000 people selling out the Azteca Stadium. There was merchandise, there were parties. The women were followed everywhere. They were like rock stars. I mean, this is a kind of slightly parallel universe of what women's sport could and should have been over 50 years ago. So we tracked down all of the women who played in the original tournament from these 6 different teams, and they tell their own story in their own words in this film. The footage itself is something that's completely almost unbelievable. It still gives us goosebumps every time we see it. I'll let Vic answer the other half of your question about the team behind it.
I actually found the story during lockdown, during COVID, and it was my husband was listening to the Radio 4 show, and one of the players, Chris Lockwood from England, was explaining about their story. And my husband just rang me up and went, you're not going to believe this. And if they haven't made a documentary about it, you should make a documentary, because it's just an unbelievable story. And it's like, how does nobody know about this? And kind of did a bit of research into it. And I was like, this is remarkable. And rang Rachel and was like, you've got to look into this. And Rachel was like, well, surely there's a Google. There's got to be something. You know, there's a Wikipedia on this. And there was just nothing. So we spent kind of quite a lot of lockdown doing the development of research. And as you say, we got in touch with the England team to start off with. And then off the back of that, reached out to the rest of the players on all the other teams. And we teamed up with Dogworth as our co-producing partner. And through them, we went with Westbrook Studios, which is Will Smith's production company. And they've backed the film. And it was through them, and they'd made the Serena, well, the Williams sisters story, the film, King Richard. So they were like, actually, they are real pioneers, sort of sporting heroes. Yes, they're tennis, but they are female pioneers within sport. And that was how we ended up with our 2 amazing exec producers, is Venus and Serena Williams.
Yeah, absolutely. 2 incredible pioneers in women's sport themselves. So they're really, you know, putting their money where their mouths are, right?
You know, they were looking actively for activist sports stories with historical weight. And they came across our pitch. They came across the work that we were doing, and yeah, decided they wanted to throw their weight behind it. And I think it's something, you know, both Serena and Venus having no longer playing are looking to what they want to do in the future. So they've always been very involved in pushing forward, you know, sort of the agenda of finding a space and making sure that, you know, female sport has that space carved out. And I think something that's so specific about this film is that it's a slightly trite line, but it is true, is that, you know, the tree is only as strong as the roots. And, you know, you need to have the stories and have the history of women's sport in order for it to keep growing, in order for it to stay as strong as it is. You know, I've made, says Victoria, and my co-director Jane, there's lots of films about football and about the geopolitics of football, about the human side of football. And one of the questions I always found, and there was an Amazon series called This Is Football that I made along with the big team of people a few years ago. And just one thing I found going all around the world is that women's football was considered to be non-commercial, was considered to be that women didn't want to play and they weren't any good. And those are questions whenever I answer, well, where are all the women involved? Those are the answers I got. But I got that almost in every country. And it started to feel like a bit of a conspiracy. It started to feel a bit like this can't really be true everywhere. You know, how can a sport that is deemed to be, you know, the most accessible, and it crosses languages, it crosses class, it crosses race, and those films that we made where it reunited the country post-war, if that's true, how come 50% of the population are going to be excluded from that? And I think I didn't grow up as a football fan at all. And I think that meant that I could ask the silly questions as well. And the questions always were, but where are the women? And what we found out through making this film is that, you know, this is the answer. They were there. There was an enormous culture of women playing all over the world in the 50s and 60s and before that. But, you know, it was that subculture in the 60s that led to the explosion of this particular tournament in 1971 and allowed it to be quite so popular.
Here in the UK, I think people know about the so-called 50-year ban on women's football. It's not really a ban of women's football. It's a ban on women using FA-affiliated facilities, right? So, as you say, it has always been happening, just not in the sort of way that men's football was. I knew about this World Cup because people like Carrie Dunn, she wrote a book, Unsuitable for Females, which is, she covers, I think they're known as the Lost Lionesses, that English team. But like, I mean, you've got Brandi Chastain in this film and she doesn't know about it. And that to me is like, that just astounds me. So how known about is this? Is it really that hidden from history?
Really is. With Brandi, we also reached out to Alex Morgan as well, who features in the film. But as Rachel will know as well, we talked to the press officer for the US soccer team and he didn't believe us. He was like, I know everything about football. This didn't happen. And it certainly wasn't 110,000 people in the final. And so we had to kind of prove that this actually existed. So yeah, there's an awful lot of how do we not know about this, which is what makes it exciting. And it feels very justified and very relevant at the moment as well, particularly what happened with the World Cup last year. But it is astonishing, the level of just no one knows.
And I think also is that it's not just that it happened, it's that it happened on this scale. It was fully supported, but not by the football establishment, but by a group of businessmen who saw an opportunity. And I think they saw that it could be commercial. They saw that they could sell tickets. And it's such a question of, you know, build it and they will come. And that's what they did. You know, and the women flocked from all over the world and to join in. And I mean, the level of the filming as well, and of the footage, you know, they used a lot of the same infrastructure they used for the Men's World Cup in 1970 in Mexico. And they treated the women like athletes. You know, something that was so extraordinary, I was finding, you say you knew about it, yes, but there was no book that was written about this either. So in terms of working out what happened in each of the matches and what happened in the tournament, the only way to do that was to go back to the original newspapers, which were in libraries in Mexico City, and translate those and work out match reports from those. Our amazing researcher Ella spent time poring over all of those and creating match reports for every match. And the amount of coverage, I would say, is more than, I mean, I sort of see newspapers lying around at the moment. I still pick them up and have a look at the back pages and just see, you know, randomly, like how many of these pages dedicated to women's football or women's sport at all. And the newspapers in 1971, there were double page, quadruple page spread in full colour, cover it, and treating the women as athletes. They were given an enormous amount of respect, mostly. I mean, obviously not across the board, and there's always exceptions that prove the rule. But, you know, this was over 50 years ago, and it was taking the sport and the idea that women should be there and should be given the same amount of coverage quite a lot more seriously than some of the coverage I'd say today.
You've got so much footage as well in the film of these matches, and it's incredible footage of these stadiums. And as you say, like, people have spotted the commercial opportunity. There's advertising everywhere. It's amazing. And the stories they tell about being treated like rock stars and going to these parties at the embassies and things like that. How easy was it to find the footage of these matches?
It was very, very difficult. It took a very long time. It took a lot of people. You know, we'll always say it's always great when you have people watching the cinema or people stay to watch the credits at the end. And if you watch the credit roller, you will see that there are teams of people. I mean, you know, from everything from legal to archivists. You know, we scoured attics, libraries, quite literally. You know, this hadn't been logged. It hadn't been kept anywhere specifically. So, yeah.
Yeah, our archive team in Mexico, again, it was one of those things that they said, we kind of know about this, but we don't know any archives here. And it was like, so we really started from scratch of just going, okay, let's just turn over every single stone that we can. And there was the thing with the newspapers as well. The archive team found this, there was a whole hoard of stuff in the library, and Rachel and Ella flew out there. And it was literally sort of white glove moment. The boxes hadn't been opened since 1971.
and three enormous crates of the original stills, because all the teams were given photographers who followed them everywhere, and sorting through those and working out who they all are. And yeah, it's a big undertaking, but incredibly worth it.
I don't know if this is a stupid question, really, apart from, you know, sexism, I suppose, is the answer, misogyny. But the question I have is, you know, so the 60s obviously is a period of like great revolution, particularly for, you know, women's rights, etc. This World Cup happens in 1971. But they're still really going against the status quo here. It is like quite a rebellious act. In the great scheme of things, when you think about the scope of like change in terms of women's rights in that period, women playing football does feel like relatively minor in terms of like all the fishes society has to fry, right? So why is this such a big deal? What is the real force behind this?
The themes that we look at in the film, you know, in terms of women's physicality, the right to self-expression through however it is that you want to express yourself, in this case, it's on the pitch through sport. And those are things that are taken away from people. I mean, we cover equal pay as well. There's a story within that. And these themes are things that haven't changed a huge amount in many cases. But really, it's a, you know, it's a bit film about power and who has that power and who has the right to tell anyone how they should and shouldn't behave and what they should and shouldn't be doing. And so that's really what it's, you know, it's, yes, in, I guess in one way it's about football and it's called Copa 71 and there's a lot of football in it. We wanted to really honour the tournament and show how exciting it was and, you know, challenge anyone to not take a look at those matches and believe that the women are incredible athletes and worth watching. But really it's a film about who has the power, who has the right to impose their idea on what someone's place in society is on anyone else.
You have Brandi Chastain and you have Alex Morgan in the documentary. You've got some US producers involved in it. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the situation in the US, because in the US, obviously, it's the women's game is quite advanced. English players were playing in the league over there before we had an established, good, semi-professional league here. That was where the opportunities were for women players. And it seems to me that it's really well developed in the US. It's really well supported by men and women. There's a huge amount of support for the national team. But when they start speaking about things, it seems to me that support is not as forthcoming. I wondered what your perspective was on that.
Well, and one of the direct reasons that football, soccer is so far advanced in the US is coming directly from Title IX in the early 70s. It was passed that any college sport had to have equal support. And so women's sport overall was much, much better funded fundamentally. But there's also an idea that soccer was allowed to be given over to the women because the men had American football, baseball, basketball, and soccer wasn't part of the culture. So it sort of became a bit of a niche sport and then women were allowed to take it on. Then obviously the more successful they get and the more it's seen around the world and they're asking for equal pay specifically and they're asking to have a voice and they're asking to be treated with the same kind of respect that people treat the men's teams in the other popular sports, that's when it does seem that the media starts to turn on them and has a bit of a problem with them. I mean, you know, comments that Trump made about Rapinoe are just extraordinary. And if, you know, I'm sure if she can get under his skin like that, then that's only a good thing. But but yeah, it seems that, as you're saying, when if they stay in their box and their box was a sport that was not deemed to be a big sport for men to play in the US, and if they stay there and they stay quiet and they don't ask for any extra money. I mean, it's the thing about money and independence. You know, financial independence is a huge part of, you know, of an activist movement and of giving women a stronger place in society. So yes, it always seems to be awkward when they're talking loudly about pay. I think that's part of it.
When we talk about the growth of women's football, and recently, you know, we've seen huge growth, particularly in this country. There's much more interest in it, and also because, you know, we're quite good at it. I think that helps, doesn't it? I have friends who are really, really into women's football. And, you know, quite recently, and I'm talking about women in their sort of late 30s, early 40s, who have never been into men's football, but they're really interested in women's football now. Do you think this recent growth is almost like an extension of the feminist movement? Do you think people are seeing it as this is another way to express our support for women in general or rage against the system? Or I don't know, what do you guys think?
All of the above. Yeah, it's kind of like my daughter plays football as well. She's 12 years old and it is that thing of, you know, you talk to her about playing in the school playground and she's like, well, we play separately because the boys are just bullies, you know. And she was like, we just get bullied out of the playground. But it's like,
I also think it's like being able to demonstrate that you can play the sport, but you can do it differently. And that's the other thing with women's football. It's not the same game as men's. And, you know, it could be arguably it's more entertaining and it's, you know, in some respects, technically a better game. That's an opinion. But I do think, and it's like it being able to take something on that's been deemed just as a male space and kind of go, well, actually, no, as women, this is what we can do. And we can do it slightly differently, but still maintain the same, you know, it's the scale of the audience and the fan base as well, which I think is really interesting to see that growing and it not just being for women, but it's also for families. And it's that you can go with your mum and dad and be supported in that way. And I think to be able to change that culture and society is something that, you know, is really important in this day and age.
I think it feels quite a special moment, doesn't it? I think, you know, when England won the Euro, I think that, you know, to all of the women I know, I feel like that really meant something to them. Whether or not they like football, it felt like a really big moment. I took my daughter, she's 3.5, I took her to the Arsenal-Manchester United game at the Emirates. It's the second time we've been, and it's such a lovely day out, and you know, I love taking her. I mean, I love football anyway, so, you know, but, and I will take her to men's football in due course, but like not at the age of 3.5, you know.
Like you say, not like a men's match where it's sort of, there's a different perception of what you're going and why you're going there as well. But this, I think, has a different vibe. And certainly from our England players, the 71ers, you know, it's the grassroots movement as well now of like actually what this can change and what this can do.
We've set up our researcher, Ella, set up and which I'm an ambassador for, is a not-for-profit organization called Our Goal, and it's about promoting grassroots football and levels of confidence and leadership through being on the pitch with young girls, and then also sort of setting up a mentorship scheme which is bringing female athletes, like amateur and professional, into schools to mentor girls who are dropping out of PE, because the, you know, the statistics of girls dropping off around 11-12 and through their teams is so high. And we feel that right now is a time, you know, we want to use the impact of this film as well as all of this zeitgeist and this feeling, you know, there's this huge upswell that, okay, there is a space for girls and for women on the pitch now. And obviously, you know, as we said, football is so accessible and it is such an easy way in. And it's not the only sport, but it is a way that you can really engage with culturally and physically. And we really hope that through Our Goal, we can start to, push a lot of that along. And I think that's what you're saying. It's exactly that. It's like sort of tapping into the zeitgeist and it's this moment of saying, okay, let's make the most of this.
Where can we see Copper 71?
So our main release is from March 8th, International Women's Day. We are on screens around the country. I think we're in around 65 cinemas. We're also doing some Q&As and special screenings in the week building up to that.
We are picture houses up and down the country will be screening the film. Head to the Dogwolf website and you can find all the listings there.
Yeah, there's some fun campaigns going on as well. I think picture house are doing, if you turn up in your team kit, whether that's your own team, grassroots team, or a team you support, then there's free popcorn on the opening weekend. So that's 8th, 9th, 10th of March is when we're encouraging teams to go along together. I think there's also, if you snap a selfie at your local cinema with your team, or as many of you as you can get there, then there's some pretty amazing prizes that can be won through an Instagram competition.
I'll put a link in the show notes so people can go and see listings and information around the film. Can I ask where we can follow you guys on social media?
Our filmmaker, our personal account, so I'm Rachel_Ramsey. We don't have a specific site or account for the film, but it's hashtag Copper71. We'd love to hear what people think as well. Get in touch and let us know what you think.
Brilliant. Okay. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Bonjour and bienvenue to Radio Dor Deud. Anna, qu'est-ce que c'est là?
Oh yes, we watched Dangerous Liaisons, released this week in the UK in 1989 and directed by Stephen Frears. It was written by Christopher Hampton, based on his Tony Award-winning play, Les Liaisons Dangereuses.
I can't even compete, Anna. I can't compete.
I can actually do a French accent, but I choose not to. It's self-adapted from the 1782 French novel of the same name. That, by the way, is 4 volumes long, which I think meets the definition of cruel and unusual. It's based in pre-revolutionary Paris, where everybody dressed like they were going to Elton John's birthday party. The film made $34.7 million from a budget of $14 million and was nominated for 7 Oscars, winning 3, although not Best Picture, or Best Actress for Glenn Close, whose history of being unlucky on the night means she shares the title for most Oscar nominations without a win with Peter O'Toole. Do you want to guess how many that is? 8. It is 8, oh. Correct, Mickey. And can I just clarify, Mickey did not just guess every number and me edit that. She guessed that correctly.
Straight with 8.
Michelle Pfeiffer, by the way, picked up a BAFTA for Best Supporting Actress. Critics liked it more than they didn't, although the casting of John Malkovich did prove more divisive, and I suppose we'll get to that later. It also starred Uma Thurman and Keanu Reeves, back when Hollywood steadfastly refused to accept that he cannot do period pieces.
Or indeed anything.
I thought you were going to be much more mean and say cannot do acting.
Is it worse than Dracula? I nearly watched Dracula after this to compare the two. I think it might be worse than Dracula, although he is in it a lot less. Anyway, the plot has been recycled, updated and parodied in a remake, a Chinese remake, a youth remake, Cruel Intentions, a Korean TV series, a 2022 US TV series, and a French and Saunders parody that spawned a short-lived sitcom, Let Them Eat Cake. Don't remember that at all. I remember the parody.
Yeah.
You go ever so gooey around then. Anyway, the plot sounds more complicated in explanation than it is to watch, so I'm going to keep it brief and not bother with anyone's titles. Needless to say, they are all rich and bored aristocrats. A rich widow, played by Close, finds out her lover is about to marry a young woman fresh out of a convent and asks her former lover to seduce the youngster. The youngster's played by Uma Thurman. He's played by John Malkovich. But he's not interested in the scheme, deciding instead to seduce a godly woman, played by Pfeiffer, whose husband is away. When Thurman's character becomes interested in a poor music teacher, played by Reeves, the two seduction plans merge together and it all ends badly for everyone. Hell, as the French say, surprise. Also Peter Capaldi.
Also yeah. Peter Capaldi. Good point. Well, mate.
Had either of you seen this before?
I had not.
No, seen the youth remake, Cruel Intentions, and I could see quite clearly where that had come from. But yeah, no, I've not seen this before.
What about you, Hannah?
Yeah, I saw it at university, which is 30 years ago, so I remembered very, very little. Can we start with Glenn Close? She is absolutely magnificent in this. She's brilliant. Yeah. I think she's amazingly good.
Agreed.
Everything about her character reminded me of the sort of conversation that goes on around sex work in feminism. That on the one hand, you could argue that she's this massively unfeminist character. She basically helps or facilitates the sexual abuse of a young woman. She hates all other women. She's filled with all of the worst traits. On the other hand, she's actually liberated and tries to encourage the thought of sex as not something that women should endure, that women should enjoy. So I was kind of surprised that I haven't seen more sort of feminist conversations around Glenn Close and her character in this. I wonder what you made of that.
She's basically Margaret Thatcher. She's like, on one hand...
Was Margaret Thatcher sex positive?
Not related entirely to the sex positivity in that, like, all of the things you said, she's been able to kind of progress in her own way and live her own life, and the things that she does, she's got, like, a very protectionist view of the world that she's created for herself and the kind of liberal environment that she's fostered for herself, but she's not fucking fussed about helping anyone else out.
Although, I would argue she thinks, and I genuinely think she believes that by telling Cecile to kind of own it, that she is helping her to have a similar lifestyle. But for a long time, I was like, oh, this film is horribly fun. It's fun, but it's horrible. And then the rape happened, and then the rape apology happened, and I was like, oh, this has taken a turn. I don't know how to feel. So I agree with you, Hannah. And we have to remember it is set in a very, very different time where women didn't have any freedom at all, apart from this kind of courtly love, and she has forged a way to live a life that she wants. And I do think she's trying to get Cecile to have a similar life.
Not out of care for Cecile, is it? It's so that...
I didn't say that.
Yeah, but so that's what I mean. Like, I don't think there's anything redeeming about her from, like, other people's perspectives.
What you just said there, Mick, reminds me of that scene in Mad Men when Peggy says to Joan, not my cats, by the way, but then you'll find out why wow. they know that. Peggy says to Joan, I've just worked out you think you're being nice to me. You think you're helping.
Yeah.
And all that time she's thought that Joan was giving her terrible advice, but then she realises that Joan thinks it is good advice.
Yeah. And the other thing I think about Glenn Close's character, in comparison to Malkovich's character, and you can't have the Marquise without the Vicomte. But it really annoyed me at the end, and I wonder if you two felt this as well, because all the way through you're like, which one of them is most monstrous? They're kind of evil yeah. and they're level pegging. And then, of course, she's most monstrous. He gets his shot at redemption, takes yeah. her down, and removes yeah. any chance she could ever have
yeah.
of redemption.
No, she carries the can.
Oh, yeah. Social death in this sense is worse than actual death, yeah. isn't it?
It's impossible to say who's the worst. They're both fucking hideous. Yeah. But she's the one who carries the can for it, not him.
Absolutely.
But that is exactly what society would have done when yeah. it was... except
probably,
but also
still
probably
now.
When it was made, and also yeah. probably yeah. now.
Agreed,
yeah.
absolutely yeah. agreed with both of you there. They are vile, Jen. They are absolutely vile, but they have some very funny lines. I laughed a lot more in this film than I thought I would. My yeah. biggest laugh out loud was when Uma Thurman just clunks on the floor. Like, I don't know how to react to this situation, so she literally swoons and falls over, and I proper quacked.
Glenn Close's sort of aside faces, she does the most magnificent eye roll at one point. And then just resets her face and goes back to her old self. Yeah. I mean, the plot is daft as hell. In fact, it reminds me of Shakespeare in the yes. sense of, like, Michelle Pfeiffer just dies of, like, death, doesn't she?
She shames herself to death, Hannah.
Yeah.
We've all nearly done it, I suppose, but, like, she literally just takes herself off with shame and guilt and dies. And her husband remains away, in inverted commas, so where the fuck is he?
Both Close and Malkovich. They both remind me of vampires. I think Close, because she has that white makeup, she looks like Gary Oldman in Dracula.
And I think you're spot on, they are
yeah,
vampires.
They feed off people, yeah.
Feed off misery, don't they? And emotions. I think Malkovich, he said at the top that his casting was divisive. I think he's pretty perfectly cast. With
oh,
the caveat that all I wanted to do was immediately watch Con Air, because he is always Cyrus the Virus to
Again.
Me. But it's showing that it's not about looks when you are seducing, and I'm going to put that in bunny ears because some of it is assaulting and harassing very much rather yeah. than what I would like to think of as seduction. But it's not about his looks. It's about his charm. It's about his determination. It's about his character.
Yeah, agreed. Everything that he does, horrifying though all of it is, it's like a massive spotlight shone on, but also a massive sort of, or maybe not that massive, a more clear-eyed version of what men do absolutely every single day to seduce women.
People were thinking he wasn't handsome enough because basically he's the leading man in this, right? And you know, you've got Keanu, who is very handsome, even if he's carved out
even
of wood.
Peter Capaldi's more handsome than him.
Right, exactly. Like, good point, Jen. Agreed.
I actually think Malkovich is hot, but
Hannah, that doesn't surprise me, but I had a feeling you might say that.
Kel, as the French say, surprise. I think the fact that he isn't technically hot really works in showing that, you know, this is how the world works. How many technically not hot men are with the world's most beautiful women? And obviously beauty, the arbitrary and all of that in the background. But yeah, it's like this is exactly how they operate.
He's spectacularly well cast. Part of me was like you're not handsome enough to be this guy, but then you're just like, you're very compelling, absolutely compelling.
And it doesn't bother me that he doesn't try an accent. He just sort of goes with
own.
He doesn't try a French one, or he doesn't try that cod English one. He just goes with his own. Yeah,
he's really camp. Like I fucking love it. I think it's brilliant.
I think he's really Malkovich. I think that's what he does, isn't he? He's John Malkovich in every single film. And with some actors, that would be really annoying, but in the same way that Sean Connery got away with it. Hello, I'm Russian. Like, I think Malkovich gets away with it as well.
The sexual politics are disastrous in this and really offensive and quite upsetting. That kind of is the point, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So it's difficult to draw a judgment on it from
that. Do you think the rape is... Do you think that's... I don't know. I feel like that was very flippantly dealt with, shall we say.
I agree with you. I think it was flippantly dealt with, but I think of its time, then it probably, like, the woman wouldn't have a leg to stand on. So what Glenn Close's character is saying is, like, who the fuck are you going to tell? Like, no one's going to believe you. Or indeed, you're the one who will be punished for it. So let's make the most of this terrible situation, although she doesn't seem to see it as a terrible situation. What I will say it did make me do was pause and check that this wasn't a Weinstein film, because that would have made me feel very pukey indeed.
Yeah.
It's Warner Brothers, isn't it? I think Malkovich and Close are absolutely, like, solid gold in these roles. They are so compelling. I fucking loved watching them. And then I think it was testament to the other actors, even Keanu to an extent, that they held their own, but particularly Michelle Pfeiffer and Uma Thurman, whose roles are quite tricksy, right? Because you're having to get this weird virtue or sexual realization across. And I just think it was beautiful to look at. The acting was utterly compelling. And I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to. I thought it was a very, very good film, despite the horrible attitude towards women and sex throughout.
Yeah, agreed. I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. And I found them to be very compelling. But Keanu, just like,
oh yeah, hi, okay, cool. Let's have a fight with swords. I've hit you with my sword.
This is like fucking hell. How did this happen? He's so pretty, but how did this happen? Come on.
You kind of answered your own question there.
No idea, but Glenn Close is a striking-looking woman, but she's not what you would call conventionally beautiful. So this whole film is about how you don't really have to be beautiful. There's no excuse.
And also, why is he fighting for her on his belongings when she's about to marry someone else anyway?
Okay, well, here we are. Maybe a slightly easier question than I suspected it might be when I picked this. Dangerous Liaisons. Dangerous Liaisons, rated or dated?
It's a historical melodrama, so obviously bits of it, the context is very dated, but it, as a film, I'm going to rate it.
I enjoyed that. I'm gonna give it a big old rated, babes. Big old rated for Dangerous Liaisons.
I am going to agree. Yeah, obviously, it's horrifying. And I would imagine it will only get more horrifying as more people come round to the point of view that the stuff that goes on in it is bad. So yeah, rated.
Le thumbs up.
Le grand thumbs up, Mick.
Yeah, I've got that like hand from Gladiators. I'm just...
Très bon.
Mickey, what terrible accents are we going to be doing next week?
America, do it. We are watching 2004's Starsky and Hutch, which stars Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson.
And Snoop Dogg.
And listeners of Blickin' will have heard me wishing it had a birthday so that we could watch Snoop Dogg as Huggy Bear. And it turns out the universe will occasionally grant you some leniency, throw you a freaking bone.
Ooh-wee. What else is...
Light spliff.
Standard issue for all women.